3D printing can enable artists to create some amazing designs in very short amounts of time. It can also be a great resource for home improvement tasks. Of all things to capture Richard H. Miller's interest in the technology, it was a broken backyard swing that needed attention. And that sparked that classic build versus buy decision.
Yeah, it's actually a pretty funny story. I had a swing in the backyard, one of those swings where, you know, two or three people can sit on and you swing. Every few years, I'd have to buy a new mattress for it, a new cover. But eventually, the feet on the bottom started to degrade. So I was like, hey, I just, you know, go to China and I'll find somebody, I'll buy the 4 feet, it'll cost like $50. You know, doesn't exist in the world. So I'm like, okay, you know, I'm in Tech Valley, I'll get somebody to print them for me. And so I'm like, oh yeah, we can do that. The model's like $300. Each one to print will be like $200. It was like, it'd be like $900 to make 4 feet for a swing that is worth like $50, you know, $100. So I'm like, well, if I have to spend that much for the feet, maybe I should just make them myself. And that's what I did. It was my first model. I made little miniature versions of the models to make sure the angles were right and all that stuff. And then eventually, you know, I printed them out of ABS, which is a little more complicated to print out of, and you need to vent it. You don't want to breathe the fumes and all that. So I had to build an enclosure for the printer. So it took me a while just to get ready to print the thing I needed to print, because I had to print all the parts to create the enclosure and all that. And so eventually I printed them, and they each took like 18 hours to print. And then I, you know, learned about different nozzle sizes and different types of filaments, the plastic that you're using. And now I've designed maybe over 100 models. So just fun stuff that helped me be more efficient or more productive, or, you know, help me adapt something for something else.
Richard has since built all kinds of items for use around the house, sometimes even letting his printer run while he sleeps. And as much as he enjoys creating those items, he enjoys sharing them too. Think open source contribution, but, you know, for 3D designs.
Usually when I do these new models, I'll post them back up to, you know, one of the sites, because of course it's a community, right? You're sharing and, you know, it's kind of like, you know, software, sharing software. It's just sick sharing models. And it's a lot of fun, and people are really supportive and give good feedback. And it's just a fun thing to do. And in fact, the MIT licenses are used on this stuff. And, you know, sometimes they want attribution, usually not. I don't care less, you know, please use my models.
For a design-minded guy like Richard, 3D printing is a practical need, but it scratches a creative itch as well.
It's just fun. I usually just do tools and things like that. I don't build art projects. I do things that solve problems. It's a lot of fun, and it, you know, makes me think about problem solving, which is, again, what UX designers do. Like this summer, I went to this thing called Burning Man, which I strongly recommend to people to try. It's definitely tough living, but the upside is people there are just spectacular, and the innovation and the creativity is just beyond mind-boggling. And plus, they got a lot of solar and LED lights and computer control and stuff that, you know, I think is very interesting. And I helped build the temple this summer, which is one of the big things on Playa. And eventually, in the end, they burn it down. And so, you know, one of the things I did, and people like to share and give things out. So what I did as my sharing, a lot of people do stickers, for example. I built little 3D printed men. Like, there's a Burning Man. It's a little symbol. You can just Google a Burning Man. And I built these little symbols out of plastic, and people put them on the back of their car, sort of as a 3D version of a sticker. And that was my share. Like, I would go around, and when you'd meet somebody, I'd hand them one of these, and they'd probably hand me a sticker or something, which I put on my water bottles. I would just say, try it. If you feel like you have that interest, you know, to be a maker, it's not that, there's not a big barrier to entry. It's not that hard to get started. I built my printer from scratch. They sent me instructions. I followed the instructions exactly. I learned a lot about the printers along the way. Not a big barrier to entry. I've taught many people how to do it, and I can teach you the basics in like 30 minutes. So it's a lot of fun if you have that kind of itch.
This is the Ready Test Go podcast, brought to you by Applause. I'm David Carty. Today's guest is 3D printing tinkerer and conversational AI expert, Richard H. Miller. Richard is a technology advisor and coach, guiding startups in emerging technologies across CRM, social networking, and other sectors. He spent 17 years at Oracle, most recently as senior director level architect, specializing in conversational AI and UX design strategy. He also wrote the book UX for Enterprise ChatGPT Solutions, which published just a couple of months ago. We talk a lot about the theoretical implementation of generative AI in the enterprise, but Richard's book aims to provide some practical guidance for creating engaging generative AI-based experiences. His book really takes more of a UX-centered approach and deals with matters like usability and functional quality, which are all too important for systems that return outputs in a matter of seconds. Let's learn from Richard how to harness the power of Gen AI in a practical way. Richard, your book focuses on designing enterprise-grade solutions using ChatGPT and other generative AI platforms, not necessarily specific to ChatGPT, but that's kind of where your focal point is in that book. But let's start by asking, what are the guiding principles of designing a high-quality, usable Gen AI-infused application or feature?
So is this going to be 2 hours on just this one answer? Because that's the kind of time it takes to cover that. But obviously, I'll go a little shorter than that. There's a lot of things in the design and development process. And in my book, I kind of go through this whole life cycle. So there's principles that we apply, practices, guidelines that might apply to the research end. Like Applause is really well known for this kind of stuff. You know, how many users should we talk to? How do we gather feedback properly? How do we answer survey questions? Like, how do we figure out what's the right thing to build, right? Because if you don't build the right thing, you might build it well, but then who needs it, right? And what I found sort of deeper into some of the chapters was I started looking at the guidelines and principles that have been around a long time in UX design. And in 1984, Smith and Mosier wrote this compendium of user interface guidelines. Now, if you do the math, because for many of the audience, that's before they were born, GUIs weren't around. Graphical user interfaces, you know, the Mac came out in 1984. So, you know, people didn't know about Xerox Star and things before that. It wasn't mainstream. No one had them. Well, it turns out what's old is new again. The stuff in Smith and Mosier, for example, has a bunch of 944 guidelines that were based on user research methods and studies. And a lot of designers today, they don't come from that kind of, I almost want to say hardcore or interaction design background. They might come from visual design background or other areas that maybe don't have that scientific underpinning. And you go back and look at these and you realize that what's old is new again. The stuff that they talked about with command line interfaces are totally applicable to the kind of interfaces we're doing now with chat, with conversational assistants. And so if you read those, you realize that there's things that we need to put into place, either through, the kind of content we're creating or the kind of, you know, how we're wrapping up our conversational assistant with instructions, right? The instructions to tell it how to behave or the type of behavior we want out of it in order for our end customer to then ask a question, right? Because we usually create these wrappers. And so a few that I'm reminded of, you know, to sort of inject into, say, prompt engineering and things like that. And I'll just give you a few examples. Consistent display format. So that's one of the guidelines in there. Well, if I talk to you in military time, then I would want the generative assistant to talk back to me in military time. And I'd want these dollars and dates and currencies or whatever, all to be in things that are consistent with my expectations, right? It's very common for people to say, you know, I want something on June 5th, you know, but if I said I want it on 6-1, is that June 1st or is that the 6th of January?
Depends on where you are in the world, right?
Exactly, yep. Right? So, you know, understanding the user's context and who they are and their profile, and then being able to apply these correctly has a big say. And another, just one other brief example, only necessary information displayed. So there's an old guideline on that. And we talk about this a lot with things like active mirroring. Like if I say to the conversational assistant, I need to book a trip for 3 p.m. on Thursday to San Francisco. It comes back and comes back to me and says, okay, you'd like something at 3 p.m. in the afternoon on Thursday the 5th to go to the San Francisco airport. And so not only is it mirroring back to me what I'm doing, but it's giving me the information so that I know that it knows what I was asking. And so all these kinds of guidelines that are out there apply to how we need to design our solutions today. And I don't mean just conversational assistants where, we're going back and forth with a chatbot, which I don't like the term chatbot, and we can get into that if you want. But there's also applications of generative assistants that are behind the scenes or are part of a hybrid solution, like a GUI that also has conversational feedback. Like if you're, doing something in a enterprise solution like Salesforce or ServiceNow, and it might be providing guidance or feedback. Oh, you should add this offer to the deal, or, here's a better way of saying that, right? So these are hybrid experiences. All those have that sort of prompt engineering, those instructions, wrapping it to help it guide it in the right direction. And these kinds of guidelines can be used to help you form those solutions.
Yeah, I always thought it was interesting having your answer read back to you from the conversational assistant sort of lens. It helps the user who's providing the input feel like they're heard, right? So it's kind of a humanistic sort of quality that it's giving to the AI, which I'm sure is not unintentional, right? But to sort of jump into the next question, in the book you reference Boomi's 6 tenets of AI readiness, and you align it back to your own findings. Now, it's too much to cover in one question, and we don't have 2 hours for this podcast, unfortunately. So let's frame it in a different way. Based on what organizations should have in place for AI implementation, where do you see them making mistakes in terms of rushing and taking a wrong turn?
Yeah, I think it goes back to the history of conversational AI and the stuff we've seen, like with Facebook, when Facebook first came out with chatbots. And everybody built a chatbot, and 99% of them failed. Why? Well, I have a term for that. It's called care and feeding. So they didn't care and feed their conversational assistant. They turned something on, and then they just never looked at it, never monitored it, never improved it. They're just like, oh, well, this must just work. And of course, it absolutely did not work. And the few that invested in creating a full service life cycle, like thinking about this as, oh, this isn't just a technology, this is a solution. And we need to figure out how to do that in a way that makes sense for our organization. Therefore, you're going to have to monitor it. You're going to want to create a life cycle of improvement, care and feeding. And so, I used to show this picture of like a fifth grader, because there used to be this TV show, everything, this Jeff Foxworthy, and they would ask questions of fifth grade questions. And you'd have to answer them, right? And so, sometimes people are surprised, like, wow, a fifth grader should know that. And it's the same with these conversational assistants. They sort of start as babies, or the first grader, saying you got to mature them. You got to teach them. You got to coach them. And, that's all part of creating a generative AI solution, this concept of fine-tuning, of including additional data, which we'll talk about, I'm sure, retrieval augmentation and things like that, generation, RAG, all these kinds of things help you create an enterprise solution that sort of is fed with the right data, provides the right result, and you know that because you've monitored it, right? You've addressed that, you see where it's failed, and then you go back and improve it. And I think that's the biggest mistake, is that people think they can just throw this stuff over the wall, just turn it on, and it just doesn't work that way.
Yeah, where you got into RAG, let's jump into that. You write quite a bit about retrieval augmented generation assessments, and those identify problems from the user's perspective. And you also write about metric-driven development, which is sort of a way to iterate on data-driven findings. How do these elements come together to help individuals refine those LLM-based outputs?
Yeah, so, I'm a big fan of making sure that We say what we're going to do. We do what we're going to do. And then we know we can verify that we did what we said we were going to do. You know, tell what you're going to tell them, tell them, tell them what you told them, right, in the presentation sense. So these metrics, and there's a lot of metrics out there. I mean, I don't know how much of the metrics we really want to go into. I spent a chapter on them, but, you know, there's user experience metrics, and there's sort of the harder core conversational AI metrics, you know, answer semantic similarity, which, you know, these kinds of things. And the importance isn't what the score is. The importance is how to understand how to get them to be better. You know, how to say, okay, this is where we are today. And it might not be very good. You know, there's some great videos from OpenAI that showed their life cycle and how they approached solutions and how they improved it over time. And I referenced it readily in the book. And my reference section, you know, I have all the links as QR codes and things like that, so people can get to this content easily, even if they buy the physical book. And it's really quite compelling because they show you in those examples and any examples that, hey, we might have started, we're like 50% good, and then we're like 70% good, and then we're like 80% good. And I have this really great graph in the book that I designed that talks about, well, how good is good enough? And so if you use these metrics, and I also go into like how to create your own metrics, if you use these metrics, you can then decide what is good enough. And the funny thing is, you know, some people will say, oh, well, 60% good enough or 80% good enough. Another you'll be like, 100% is good enough. And I'm like, well, what percentage is your human agents doing now? If we're talking about like agent support or, you know, FAQs or, you know, support on, say, some type of social media channels. How good are they now? How accurate are they? Are they 85% accurate, 90% accurate? So you probably can do better, but just like that agent who's 95% accurate, I bet you there's something unique about that, him or her, than the agent that's 70% accurate. So how can we translate that into a digital assistant agent that, of course, runs 24/7, can support 1,000 interactions simultaneously, right? How do you model that? And so these metrics are what you can use to see that you're approaching your goals. And of course, you might have this expectation, well, the closer you get to your goal, the more costly it is to get there, right? It's, you know, it takes 20% of the effort to get from 70 to 90% success, but it might take 60% of the effort to get from 90 to 97% success, right? So there's a cost-benefit ratio to quality. Well, there always has been, right? I mean, cars, anything is the same way, you know? So, you know, I think if you look at those metrics, you can use those to drive your success. Your engineers can use them, your product management can use them, and certainly designers and researchers can use them so that you can make better informed decision.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned the metrics. Some of them that you mentioned in the book include semantic similarity, answer correctness.
Right.
Definitely make sure you check that out in the book. It's really well outlined. But it sounds like what's really more important is that you are improving, for one, and that your team has trust in the metrics that you're using. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's a good point. There are metrics, and I even go through this in the book, that I struggle with, that I don't think are on point yet. And I think what we see here is that we have this immature space. You know, I mean, I've been doing conversational assistants for about 7 years. Some of the metrics only came out this year, right? And so I saw some examples where, you know, if you run the metric again, because of the way the math works, the answer is not the same. It's not deterministic, because if you understand conversational assistants and the way these models built, the models themselves are not deterministic. And what we mean by that is if you ask it the same question again, you're not going to get the same answer, right? And that's just the way they work. Whereas at the older systems, the conversational systems we've had traditionally, like Google and Alexa, things like that, that they were based on originally, if you ask it the same question, you're going to get the same answer, or at least in the same format. Obviously, the data might change. If you ask the weather, you know, it's going to tell you the new number, but that structure of that sentence is basically a template, and that template was filled in with the data. Now, with conversational assistance based on AI, you can adjust you know, there's these sliders, effectively, these variables you can set to say, well, how deterministic do you want this answer to be? And it will tend to pick, you know, if you push it to the right, you're going to tend to pick a more, a higher likely answer to repeat, right? It'll give you kind of more consistent answers. But it's also not as, I don't want to say human, but, you know, it's going to be not as natural as you might expect. And we want that natural thing because that also helps build that trust that you're mentioning. And trust is really in the data, but it's also in the way you say something, right? You know, if somebody comes up to you and says, and they're a salesman, they say, oh, trust me, I'm going to get you the best deal. What's your first instinct?
Why should I trust you, right?
Of course, there's no way, right? Of course, this guy, person, is not going to be trustworthy. Anybody who tells you they're trustworthy is probably not. So we have to be careful with that. And these are, it's just one set of approaches to create that conversational system that's trustworthy. And from my research, the thousands and thousands of analytics we've gone through, people do tend to trust this stuff. And so when they lie or create hallucinations, you know, and things like that, or just go off the rails, we would say, meaning they start answering questions or start saying things that aren't actually what you're talking about. There's something else. And the user generally doesn't read. That's one mantra that we talk about. Users don't read. So they don't notice that they're actually off track. And they start answering questions based on something that they're not even in the right ballpark. And so their answers are wrong because the question was wrong. And so there's a lot of this going on in conversational systems, and people complain about it. So this kind of hallucinations and these issues, these are things that help build trust. And if we can get rid of them, the more we can get rid of them, the more we can keep the user on track, the better the solutions will be. And I'm pretty bullish on it. I mean, there's a lot of pace and speed going on in this industry to really improve this kind of stuff. And I do think it, yeah, a lot of smart people, a lot of way smart people than me, right? That they're really, you know, these data scientists and the people at all these different model solutions. You know, we don't expect most enterprises are going to build their own model. It's not practical. Just like most companies don't build their own operating system. They don't build their own Java language. You know, they use stuff that's out there, but they can adapt it to be their own. And they certainly, the thing that interests me is in the enterprise space is that they have a wealth of data about their customer that is not exposed to these models. It's not exposed to the internet. And that's where their value is. So if we can build that trust, you know, and use these metrics and things like that to create a high quality solution, which includes generative AI, they're going to be able to create a very high return on investment.
Yeah, a lot of smart people and a lot of investment was the other thing I was going to say there. But, you know, the QA team should be establishing a test matrix for these types of systems, right? And the value of having these different kinds of test suites. Specifically, you write about having in-domain, out-of-domain, random, neighbor, and language test cases for the business areas under test. At a high level, can you kind of give us an idea of what those different test cases cover? And how do you go about finding that right mix?
Yeah, the right mix is actually tough to do. I mean, I cover it kind of extensively in the book. So I adapted this from some friends of mine who was building test matrix for a conversational assistant that was doing sort of an FAQ kind of thing for their product. They're like, oh, you know, what platform can I use? What version of the software can I use? And how do I get it to do this? And they wound up eventually growing their test cases to the hundreds of thousands. And the reason why it grows, and of course, this is where automation comes in. I mean, applause again, you know, this is why you guys should be talking about this kind of stuff. The automation that comes into play means that it doesn't matter if I have hundreds of thousands because the automation will run it for me. But you have to have the right test cases. And I think that's your point. So in domain is sort of the idea that if I have a conversational system that covers, say, 10 areas, 10 topics, each of those topics alone should have a set of test cases. So if I'm going to cover something like iPhone battery and screen fixes. You know, we all have phones, they all break screens, they all need batteries. That's the domain, like how to fix your iPhone for, like, you know, performance or screen being broken. You're going to have a set of questions that are very specific to that area. And you're going to generate a set of test cases to maybe get, you know, get the system to make sure that it understands those questions. But if you take something else that has a broken screen, like a TV, and you ask, well, how do I fix my broken screen? You don't want it to be answering about an iPhone when you're really talking about the TV. Like, you know, and let's maybe take Samsung as an example. The Samsung would have a phone and it would have a TV, you know, dead pixels on a phone, dead pixels on a TV, broken screen, broken screen. You don't want those to overlap, or you might wind up with multiple in-domain tests that look very similar. And so by creating a matrix out of this, out of, you know, each of them having their own standalone questions that apply to it, when you go across the matrix to say, well, let me ask the Samsung TV questions in a larger context that includes phones and TVs, how will they respond? And you want them to respond correctly, which means you might need to have some kind of additional data. Oh, did you mean a phone or did you mean a TV? Right. So the conversational assistant needs to understand how to disambiguate between these two very common questions. And then you have things like random, which are like, can I Mambu dog face to the banana patch?
I can't tell you how many times I've asked that question to generative AI.
It happens all the time, right? That's actually a Steve Martin, my favorite album of all time, Wild and Crazy Guy. But that's, you know, how to teach a kid wrong. You know, the first day of school, you teach the kid wrong language. First day of school, he raises his hand and says, can I have Mambu dog face in the banana patch? You know, what are you saying? It's, you know, so you want to see how your system responds to sort of random or off-axis questions. And so if you think about each of these as, you know, I have like 10 areas, 10 products or 10 areas of interest going down the left of a spreadsheet, and across you have in-domain and out-of-domain and then random and then neighbor. Neighbor means, you know, ask me the Samsung TV question, but do it in context of the phone. You wind up with a matrix of a lot of questions, and that's okay, right? And then you layer that in with language support, and all of a sudden all that gets multiplied. And that's why this matrix can get so big so quickly. To answer your question about how many, I have some rules of thumb in the book, you know, and you're going to look at, like, well, how big is my area? You know, is it a really niche thing where I only could possibly ask five questions? And then even if you ask ChatGPT to generate other questions, to synthetically generate questions to build into my test cases, they might all look the same. And so it's a very small area. So you'll have less test cases. But overall, you know, when we're talking about businesses, generally speaking, there's a lot of things going on. I'll give you one brief example if you want. There was a company that has a hotel, and I think it was in the Netherlands. And they were like, oh, we're going to build a conversational assistant. There's like, there's like 25 things that a customer would ask when they call the front desk. And of course, the front desk gets busy in the morning because everybody's checking out. So they want to create a conversational assistant that would handle these kinds of questions, like, can I get a late checkout? Or, you know, what time is checkout? Or, you know, I don't know, what time is breakfast? You know, these common questions, right? Well, it turns out by the time they were done, they had over 500 topics, not 25, 500. So their perception of what was in the data was off by more than order magnitude. And I go into that extensively in the first few chapters of the book, because if you do your user research, for example, if you look at existing chat logs, or you look at the type of questions that customers ask through service requests, or you go into, you know, social media and see, yes, you can get a very good idea of what's going on. And then you can start prioritizing that backlog, if you will, and the kinds of things, well, what kind of data do we need to answer these questions? What kind of APIs do we need so that we can get the right answers for the right model, for the right version, so that we don't, you know, give them the wrong answer, right? If you want to reboot a Mac, it's different depending on the kind of Mac you have. So that kind of creates this wealth of test cases that you'd want to do. And the worst part is that when you go to a new model, there's no guarantee that it's backwardly compatible. So having all these test cases in place is really important, because you might not be at the same level you think you're going to be when you go from 3.5 to 4.0, you know, in a model like OpenAI. So there's a lot that's dependent on doing good test cases. And the other part about test cases that I think is important, it's not just about the QA engineer anymore, because the QA engineer, English might not be their first language. And we're talking about, and, you know, they might have a language that might be useful to that language matrix. But who's going to be able to interpret the quality of those results? Because it's not black and white. It's not yes and no. Did it pass the test case? Well, it might sort of pass the test case. Well, how do you judge that? Well, you have to read the results. You have to see how it responded, because, again, we said it's not deterministic. So the team has to be more than just the QA engineer who's really good about the automation and the systems. It's got to be those linguists and those writers and the product managers and the designers providing and contributing to what are good answers to those test matrix.
This kind of dovetails a little bit into the dynamic nature of generative AI technology and the demands of the business. Those things are kind of fluid, right? Throughout the book, you sort of encourage the reader, perhaps most importantly, to continue to learn and evolve. Tell us why this is so important in this area, especially within the context of design thinking.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's a good question. If you read a newspaper from like 50 years ago, you can read it fine. It's, you know, now 300 years ago might be a little more of a challenge, right? Language does evolve. But humans have not really evolved. My response rate, you know, my ability to react to something, my visual system, my brain, the way that I remember things has not changed during the life cycle of the compute era. Just, we don't evolve that fast. But what has changed is the speed at which technology has incurred, the speed at which change now occurs. I mean, you know, we get new iPhones every year. Sometimes they're more innovative than others. Now, generative AI, you know, you could kind of say the dawn of that was basically 2 years ago with, you know, OpenAI's model release. Granted, we've been working in the field for years before that, but that was really when it stepped into the limelight. So when you think about that and all the channels that might occur, you know, the voice channels, the GUI channels, text channels, we as design people, design thinking, need to take that stuff we started the first of the conversation, the historical underpinnings of interaction design, and we need to apply them, the psychology, the human factors, linguists, you know, the product design expertise, and apply them now. ChatGPT is not very good with novel solutions. Right? It can't invent things, not very well. That's still on us, right? So we need to evolve our understanding of how people interact. And the thing is, in our space, in the design space, there are people who know interaction design and psychology and human factors. And then there's a lot of designers who don't. And so I think it behooves us to get those designers to kind of understand the psychological underpinnings and the human factors of humans so that they can adapt their solutions to be more functional, usable, apply to necessary interactions, and be engaging. And I say it in that order because in my book, that's one of my little mantras. It's F-U-N-E, funny. That's how I remember it, right? Because we want functionality. You know, it's got to do the things we want. We want it to be usable. We've learned that from the iPhone, you know, like, every, you know, we want products that we can connect with. But it has to be those needed features, you know, that had to be the necessary features. Don't give me stuff that I don't need, gets in my way. And of course, engagement is this thing about, you know, color and style and feeling and tone. And we do a lot of that with conversational AI, like creating the right tone for a conversational assistant. If you're a bank, you're going to have a very different tone than if you're a surf shop dude, you know, let's hang 10, right? And we want that connection. We want that connection in our conversational assistants when they're interacting like that. So yeah, I think there's still a lot for us to learn and evolve and adapt to the current technology.
especially when you're talking usability across the scale of these generative AI platforms with the massive quick adoption that they've all had, right? Because it's going to be usable by a wide range of people, and they all have to have some measure of usability there. But I want to get into the final question here for you, Richard.
Okay.
Your career has spanned engineering, UI, and conversational design, among many other areas. Over the long term, how do you see AI, and Gen AI in particular, disrupting those disciplines? What's a realistic assessment there?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we all want to pontificate on the future. You know, I spent the day with this famous author, Alvin Toffler, and he wrote Future Shock, you know, and these waves of innovation and stuff like that. And I think that when you write a book like this, you know, I try not to write the book so that it would be out of date the next day, right? I wrote it along generalizations and things that we can apply 2, 3, 5 years down the road. And that was hard to do because I had to stay away from certain kinds of decisions or things I would execute on because they're going to be out of date. And so what's coming next? It's hard for me to say. I think that we need to still get past this chasm of chaos, you know, and sort of the crap that's out there. And there's plenty of that, right? I mean, I just think there's a wealth of, dead soldiers on the side of the road, so to speak, if you take that concept. And what's going to be left, though, are things that are kind of functional and will grow and mature over time and will keep you on track. I don't think there's one good answer here, but you mentioned something a minute ago I'd like to bring into this part of the conversation. And you mentioned, like, and I sort of was like, different types of audiences. And, you know, we know that conversational assistants can have biases because the data is biased. And we try to get that out of the data. And then even there's data in enterprise data can be biased. And I don't mean necessarily like social issue bias, like, you know, African-American or Chinese, or it's just bias in the data. It could be against another product, for example, biases against, you know, a third party, because it could be written up that way. And then all of a sudden thinks, oh, I should say bad things about it. But I would also focus on things like the age of the adults, like who's using this product. Is it for kids? We have to be more careful. Is it for younger adults? They're probably more flexible. Can we get it to the older adults? So when the older adults start to experience this stuff and use it effectively, you know, I think that's when, like, things have arrived. When somebody who's not naturally going to use this kind of technology can use this technology, then it's arrived. That is, many people now use iPhones that are in their 60s and 70s that my dad was 90 something, never quite got it, you know, but his wife, you know, my stepmom, she uses her iPhone. She texts regularly, you know, and she's, so when you get that level of adoption, then you're going to see more disruption, you know, because it's going to permeate into far more parts of our life. And I think ChatGPT and AI in general, it's going to be everywhere. You know, some are going to be harder to get there. It'll take more time, you know, certain areas that we want to be more careful and more cautious. But I think, you know, there's a bigger return on investment when you talk broader, you know, and I think that's, it's going to be disruptive everywhere. So I'm hopeful that we will make the right decisions.
All right, Richard, lightning round questions for you today. First, what is your definition of digital quality?
Does it meet the user's expectations? So if it meets the expectations, you know, then we have quality. Do we want higher quality? Great, let's keep going.
What is one digital quality trend that you find promising?
User metric driven development. So, you know, we talked a lot about that today. I would even settle for something as simple as a net promoter score if I had to start with something really trivial. You know, it's that one that some people probably know it. It's that one question that asks, how likely are you to recommend this service or product to your friends? It's on 1 to 10 scale. That's a start. Some people don't think it's enough. I can agree with that, but at least it's a start. So just getting data-driven decisions, I think, is a big deal now.
What is your favorite app to use in your downtime?
Well, I kind of mentioned, you know, like Tinkercad and Prusa 3D, so I don't want to belabor that. I am a word person now because, you know, we write copy. We talk about style and tone. So I actually play a lot of word games. I don't play 3D shooter games and things like that, but I play like Words with Friends and Wordle and even the LinkedIn games. You know, anything with words, I like to play those kinds of things. And that's sort of, you know, that's my 10 minutes of downtime a day.
Finally, Richard, what is something you are hopeful for?
I want to see more successes and failures. I want to be able to read the New York Times and not have them discuss, you know, all the crap, you know, all the crappy AI by the side of the road. You know, I think that I want that rhetoric to die down, and I want us to get into that curve up of successful implementations.
Well, Richard, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much. It was fun talking with you today.
That was Richard H. Miller. You can find the link to his book, UX for Enterprise ChatGPT Solutions, in our podcast notes. Be sure to check it out. Thanks to our producers, Joe Stella and Sam Susala, and our creative team, including Megan Golick and Carly Searles. Subscribe, drop a comment, leave a review, or let us know what you think about the podcast by emailing at podcasts@applause.com. On to the next one.